Thank you for the opportunity for me to present this material. As Mo mentioned before, this is the second time. I'll give you a little background. A couple months ago, the brethren in Lincoln, Rhode Island, decided to do a lesson on evidences for a God. And they asked me, because I was finishing with a bachelor's degree in biology, to present some of the things that I had sort of read about and learned about in my classes that pertain to the creation and evidence for a creator that we see. So let's see if we can make this. All right. So again, this is a lot of the things in this lesson are not the typical things that you would hear, you know, about how the nature shows evidence for a God. A lot of these things are just things that I've read about and thought, you know, that sort of shows evidence to me. But you will see a couple things that you may have heard before, but I think will be edifying. Let's see. I should see notes right here, and I don't, but it's okay. All right, so we'll start by talking a little bit about the nature of evidence from nature. And the first thing I want to point out is that nature is a universal language. And by that I mean that you don't just have to speak a specific language to be able to interpret the evidence that we see in nature. And that's the wisdom of God setting nature as something that all men, whether they speak a language or speak no language at all, can understand and see the evidence for God in it. So it's a universal language. And this evidence from nature is used to support various theories as to the origin of life on Earth. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, is two of the major theories of life on Earth, one being evolution and the other being creation. And I'll just point out the fact that tonight's lesson is specifically looking at evidence for a God or a creator. So it's not necessarily pointing to the God of the Bible that we believe in. All right, just a little introduction to start us off. So evolution has been described as change over time and the characteristics of a population of organisms due largely to natural selection. And that was Darwin's description in On the Origin of Species in 1859. So Darwin is sort of the poster child for evolution, the person that, you know, we hear as the guy who really promoted natural selection and evolution. But I'll point out that Darwin wasn't the first. 1,200 years before, this had been presented in not so precise words, but this idea that all life on Earth originated from a common ancestor. And even Darwin didn't provide a lot of support for this. His support came from observations of things like finches in the Galapagos Islands, and what he was doing was looking at these birds, seeing similarities, and drawing the conclusion that all these finches must have come from a single finch species, or a kind of finch. And then in his book On the Origin of Species, he postulated that perhaps this could go even further back, so that not only finches had a common ancestor, but also all birds, and perhaps all animals, perhaps all life on Earth. So while he didn't provide a lot of evidence for long-term evolution, he postulated it, and it started this ball rolling where people began to really take on to this hypothesis. So evolution applied more broadly than Darwin's version is, you know, applied over a very long period of time, and it's the claim that all living things share a common ancestor. So that's what we're going to be using as a definition tonight. And in the scientific world, if I stated this as evolution, they would say, wait, that's a fact, right? Not a theory. Because it is a very widely accepted theory of the origin of life on Earth. And I just pointed this out. There's a book called In 6 Days. I meant to bring it with me today. If you look it up, In 6 Days is written by 50 different scientists in a variety of different fields. And basically, it's a testimony from each of these scientists as to why they believe in a God. Many of them have always believed in a God, but many of them started out, you know, believing in evolution, and the more they studied biology, the more they studied astrology, any of these scientific fields, the more they studied it, the more they came to believe in a God. And so this is just a small sampling of the scientists out there, but, you know, at least there's 50 right there who believe that there is a God, there is a creator. So intelligent design, as opposed to evolution, is the claim that certain features of the universe or the living world necessitate the existence of a creator or an intelligent designer. So intelligent design is sort of the creation without the religion aspect of it. So all it's saying is that there is a creator, and it's not specifying who that creator is or what our response to that creator should be. So a lot of times when I challenge, you know, fellow students or teachers at the college to consider this idea of a creator, I'll approach it from the standpoint of intelligent design, because it's not necessarily convincing them of the Bible or convincing them of Jehovah, just convincing them that there is a creator. So that's intelligent design. And like I said, it's a secular theory, so it ignores who this creator is. Now, for those of us who do believe in the Bible and in Jehovah, we know that intelligent design, according to the Bible, occurred in 6 literal days, as described in Genesis 1. And again, so the way we describe it from an intelligent design standpoint compared to an evolution standpoint is the fact that, yes, we see some small evolution that occurs on a small scale, and we describe this as a tree. So, for example, you see here pictures of Drosophila. This is the fruit fly, common fruit fly. All of these fruit flies that you see in the picture came from a single strain from a scientist who is studying mutations in this fruit fly. And you can see a variety of different colors and shapes and sizes. And all of these different fruit flies did in fact come from one fruit fly. And this happens in the wild all the time. And this process is called natural selection. So it's not that we're claiming as Christians that we don't believe in natural selection. There's, you know, heaps of evidence for natural selection. We do see evidence for that. However, what we're saying is it doesn't go all the way back to one common ancestor. Instead, you have a tree. You have a tree that has multiple, or in evolution, you have a tree with all the animals that goes back to a common ancestor. In the intelligent design theory, you have all of these fruit flies that come from a single fruit fly, and you have all these finches that come from a single finch, and all of these horses that come from a single horse. So that's the idea of a whole forest of trees rather than one tree. And a lot of the evidence that we see in support of evolution or intelligent design is common to both of the theories. So you start out with this evidence. It supports man's theory, whether it be evolution or something else. And then once you have this theory, then you use this theory as sort of your glasses or your basically your framework for which you view more evidence. So once you have this idea that everything evolved from a common ancestor, then you return back to the evidence and you start seeing more evidence for man's theory. And in the same way, someone else will take that evidence and see, will come to the conclusion that everything that we see today came from an intelligent designer, and specifically in this case, from the biblical creator or God. And then once you have this belief in the Bible and a creator, then you can look back at the evidence and you'll see more evidence for a creator. And a lot of people will look at that and say, well, isn't that circular reasoning, going from the evidence to the theory and back in the circle? But really, it's just a way of coming up with a framework for what you see and then returning to the evidence and checking it. So you say, well, I think that everything came about by evolution. Well, then you look back at the evidence and you check it, and you look at another case and say, okay, that works. And then if you get to some stage where you come back to the evidence and you say, well, that doesn't fit the theory, then that's when you have to adopt a different theory. So a lot of the evidence that we see for intelligent design is also used for evolution. We'll see a little bit about that later. So here's an example of that. Homology is where you have similar structures in different animals or different animal groups. So in the picture here, you see on the right you have a whale fin, and then you have a bird wing, and then a dog leg and a human arm. And if you look at the bones, and they're colored so that you can see the similar bones in each, each of these appendages has a very similar arrangement of bones, a very similar number and arrangement. They're just different in size and shape. And so an evolutionist would look at this and say, oh, well, that must mean there is a common ancestor to all of these different organisms, because they have all these shared characteristics. However, someone who believes in intelligent design would look at this and say, that's evidence for a common designer, because a common designer would use similar building blocks, similar themes when he designs the different animals. So that gives you an idea of how different evidence can be used for different theories, for the same evidence for different theories. All right, so a little bit more about intelligent design. So I think we all understand that something that has or exhibits design must have a designer. So if you look at something like a motor, you look at it, and it obviously exhibits a lot of designs. They say there must be someone who made this motor. But how do you determine what design is? If you look at a plant, can you say that that is design? Well, the way we define design is by specified complexity. So the first part of this, specified, first specified complexity is used in a variety of different fields, including archaeology, anthropology, forensics, etc., where you're looking for patterns that show specified complexity. Complexity is just what it sounds like. It's a pattern, something that's complex about the system that you're looking at or a series of numbers that you're looking at. And specified means it's very specific. So, for example, can chance produce complexity? Think of a random letter sequence. If you have a random letter generator that's coming up with this random letter sequence, can you end up with some complexity? Well, it's very rare that it would happen, but you might end up with, say, a word. You might end up with a word just coming out of these random letters. So that would be complexity. It's a pattern of the letters. But then, can chance produce specification? Specification is something that shows purpose, something that shows function. So from a random letter sequence, can you end up with a Shakespearean sonnet that shows purpose and meaning? Well, no, of course you couldn't. You could have this thing running forever for infinity and never end up with a Shakespearean sonnet. So that's one of the criteria for determining whether something is actually designed or not is, first of all, it has to show complexity, and second of all, that complexity has to show some sort of function. And then before we move on, when you think about evolution, evolution says that everything came about by a series of mutations. But when you think about a mutation, what do you picture? If you say that your child was born mutated, is that a good thing? If the doctor comes in and says, you know, your child has several mutations, well, do you jump up and down and say, oh, right, you know, it's a superior child? No, it's a mutated child. Something has gone wrong. So in general, mutations go wrong. Usually they do not produce something that's superior. So to say that you can get a Shakespearean sonnet by all of these mutations is, you know, just incredible by the literal sense of the word. So the first example we'll look at is the bombardier beetle. So first we'll start from some non-human examples. The bombardier beetle is a very cool little bug. And what's more incredible is the fact that it has these two highly noxious chemicals held in two compartments in its body. First of all, hydrogen peroxide, which is extremely reactive, and hydroquinone. So these two components together are extremely combustible. And so you might wonder, well, how could they end up together in this one beetle? Well, you have, together with these two chemicals, a reaction inhibitor. This is a small chemical which basically keeps these two reactive compounds from combusting and creating a reaction. And in these combustion tubes, where the two chemicals are mixed and then ejected as a defense mechanism, are two chemicals, catalase and peroxidase. These are enzymes or proteins that speed up the process. So in the beetle's body, where you have this reaction inhibitor, the reaction would never take place because it's so slow, the inhibitor is keeping it from happening. But with these enzymes, the enzyme basically counters the activity of the inhibitor and allows this reaction to happen very quickly. In addition to this system of the paired combustion tubes, you have the glands that secrete these different chemicals, you have the sensory systems that sense when a predator is approaching it, and then you have the muscles that control those glands that then will squirt out these noxious chemicals. So together, what you end up with is a very high-speed combustion of chemicals, which will then either kill the predator, stun the predator, or scare the predator away. If this happened in the body of the beetle, there would be no more beetle. If this happened, you know, as it was, you know, ejecting from the beetle, again, there would be no beetle. So the fact that it happens at this very instant when it's left the beetle and is near the predator shows a lot of design. And this brings about the idea of irreducible complexity. And that's a term that was first coined by Michael Behe. He believes in intelligent design. He has a PhD in biochemistry, and he's in Pennsylvania right now. And he wrote several books on this, and basically irreducible complexity is described as a system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic overall function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes a system to effectively cease functioning. So So that means that every single part of the system is required for the end reaction. And if you take out any part of this, you take out one of the glands, you take out the inhibitor, you take out the muscle, none of this would work, and what would happen? The beetle would blow up. If it didn't have the inhibitor, there would be no beetle. If it didn't have the enzymes, there would be no reaction. So every part of this is necessary, and this brings about the question with the bombardier beetle, how could this have evolved? Because without every component of the system would do nothing for the beetle. And according to the theory of evolution, traits that are passed on from generation to generation are those that are beneficial to the organism. So if you have, let's say, one gland with hydrogen peroxide is expensive to produce by the beetle. So why would it keep it around if it can't do anything with it? If you have the two chemicals, then the beetle wouldn't live, so it wouldn't be passed on to the next generation. If you had, say, the two chemicals and the inhibitor, but you didn't have the enzymes, then the reaction would never happen, and therefore it wouldn't be beneficial. So the idea is you would have to have all of these different components formed at the exact same time in one organism for it to be passed on to the next generation. And even an evolutionist will tell you that that the odds of that are just incredibly high. So here's another example. You may have heard of this one, that the bacterial flagellum, the bacteria, the one shown here is E. coli. E. coli have these flagellum, which are small rotating tails, which allow them to move about in aquatic environments, such as your gut. And so all of these flagellum work by a series of proteins, which you see in the picture. And the names of these proteins are the stator, the rotor, the drive shaft, the U-joint, and the propeller, among others. So what does this sound like to you? Well, it's a motor, obviously. And if you looked at a motor in a car, you'd say, well, something must have produced this. And in the same way, anyone should be able to look at this and, with common sense, say something must have created this motor. It's very complex. This motor spins at 100,000 RPMs, which is incredibly fast. It's water-cooled by a system of enzymes around the outside that create a reaction to flow water around these enzymes to keep them cool and to keep them from overheating, just like in your car. It has sensory input to allow the bacteria to move about in the environment, to follow food, to run away from predators. It has two what you might call gears that can go forward or reverse by the direction of its spinning. And altogether, it has a total of 40 total proteins that make up this system. So again, this is an example that shows two things. First of all, it shows irreducible complexity. If you had any one of these proteins missing, the whole function, the whole system would not work. And scientists have actually studied this. What they do is they find the genes in the bacteria that encode for these different proteins, and what they'll do is they'll go and basically take out one of these genes at a time and see what happens. And if they take out the gene for, say, the stator, then the system doesn't work. They take it out for the rotor, the system doesn't work. And so this shows this idea of irreducible complexity. All the parts are necessary for the whole to function. And it also shows specified complexity. Obviously, it's very complex, and obviously it's very specified. In other words, it has a function, it has a purpose to propel this organism around. All right, so this is a little bit different idea, but in science, what you'll find is a lot of systems in nature are based on mathematical principles, and some of these include the golden ratio, the golden angle, golden rectangle, Fibonacci sequence, logarithmic spirals, fractals. These are all patterns of numbers, patterns in math that are very complex and have been shown over the years to be the basis of a lot of, you know, the math that we learn today. And in nature, we see these patterns, these complex patterns. For example, you have here the base of a fern that is growing, the apical meristem, and the division of the cells at the base, at the tip of this stem, show a Fibonacci sequence in the way that they divide and rotate around. And so we have complexity that's shown here, but we also have purpose, because the purpose of this provides straight growth. So you don't have this mass of cells that's just growing, or you wouldn't end up with a plant. You have this organized straight growth that produces a stem and then eventually divides to form the plant. Galileo once said, "Mathematics is the alphabet with which God has written the universe." And indeed, that's what we see. Math that we teach in our classrooms, when you go way back, you find that it was eventually was based in astrology and biology and these patterns that we see in nature. Here are some more examples. So the top of an acorn, the rotation of those hexagons on a pineapple, you have broccoli and cauliflower, daisies. All of these different flowers show this rotation of numbers that exhibit a Fibonacci sequence. Again, very complex, very specified, so that it organizes the shape and function of these different plants. All right, so now we're going to look at a couple examples from the human body. The human eye is extremely complex, both on its surface when you think about the amazing function of the human eye, but also when you look more in depth at the detail of the eye. So we're going to focus in on the retina of the human eye, which is the back lining of the eye, which senses the light information, creates a signal which goes to the brain, and then is interpreted. So scientists for years have called the human eye, have referred to the retina of the human eye as inverted. They say it's an inverted retina. And what they mean by that is that the photoreceptor cells, the cells that sense the light, are on the back of the retina. So there's several cell layers. There's three major cell layers, and the photoreceptors are on the back layer of that retina. And the reason they call it inverted is because in most animals, especially aquatic animals, have those photoreceptor cells on the outside. And what that means is the light first contacts those cells and is sent to the brain. But in the human eye, the light that we see passes through several cell layers before being received and then sent to the brain. And so this is a very anthropocentric way of saying it, to say that this is an inverted retina, especially when we know that God created the eye. God doesn't create inverted things. He creates it the way it should be. And if you look at, so this is what I was talking about, the three layers. And the top layer, which is the back of the retina, is the last to receive this light, which means most of the light has already been filtered out by the other cell layers. And what evolutionists will say is that this is a poorly developed, poorly designed system. Well, recently a scientist decided to study this and found that if you have this photoreceptor cell layer on the outside, when the light hits it, it automatically kills all the cells because the light is too intense. It like bleaches the cells so that they can't receive the light signal and send it to the brain. And so what they're finding is this is actually a very complex, very specified system in which those outer cell layers first dampen the light, sort of like sunglasses, so that once it reaches the photoreceptor cells, it can be interpreted. And then when you think about the squid eye, which they say is a verted eye, in other words, it's not inverted, the squid eye is the opposite way, and it makes sense because the squid lives deep in the ocean where very little light comes out, and it needs those photoreceptor cells right out at the front. So again, we see this example of something that shows specified complexity. All of these different cell layers are necessary, and we see this idea of specified complexity, where the complexity is obvious with these different cell layers and the signaling that goes on. And now the specification is obvious in that there's a purpose for this inverted eye, as they call it, to filter out the excess light. All right, one more. This is the human tears, and this is one that I found really interesting. This one isn't well studied. This is a very recent study that showed some incredible things about human tears. First of all, human tears have an enzyme in them called lysozyme. It's a very common enzyme that is a 95% effective antibacterial and antiviral agent. So you have this liquid around your eyes that is preventing bacterial or viral infections. And then there's been studies that show that when people cry, they feel better immediately afterwards. And a lot of times you'll hear that. People say, well, just, you know, cry it off and you'll feel better. And so in this recent study, what they did was to compare different tears. They studied tears from irritation, like, say, an onion squirting in your eye. They showed tears from emotion. And then thirdly, they showed tears that just normally help to keep your eye moist. And what they found was major differences in these different types of tears. So in the typical tear that just keeps your eye moist, you have, again, this protein lysozyme. So you have this basic saline solution that keeps your eye moist, keeps it from drying out, and keeps it from infection. And then when you have irritation tears, it's very similar to the normal tears, except that you have this extra component that will then break down the irritant that's causing you to cry. So you see this purpose behind it. It's not just the same tear for everything. If you don't have, if it's just In other words, the normal tier has a basic function to keep your eye moist, whereas the irritant tier, irritation tier, has a function to break down the irritant. And then thirdly, the most interesting one was the emotional tier. The emotional tier was found to have all sorts of toxic compounds in it. And at first, this was very surprising to the scientists. They said, you know, well, why would tears have all these toxic compounds in it? And what they found is that it's been known for a long time that negative emotions in your body create toxic byproducts. And these cycle around your body, and basically they make you sick. And what the tears do is they collect all of these different toxic compounds in the body, and they secrete them out the eye to get rid of them. So crying when you have emotions is a way of cleansing your body of all these toxic chemicals. And this was just incredible to scientists, because they always thought that tears were tears. And what they're finding is that tears in different scenarios have different functions. There's also a genetic disorder called familial dysautonomia. And this occurs when someone can't produce tears. And as a result, they always have to use eye drops to keep their eyes moist. And what they found is that when these people have negative emotions, when bad things happen in their lives, they have a hard time dealing with it. Why? Because they can't secrete all these toxic chemicals from their body. So again, we see the specified complexity, irreducible complexity. And what's really interesting is that the way this was discovered was by a scientist who believed in intelligent design, who looked at this and said, I bet there's some reason why we cry when we have emotions, why we cry when our eyes are irritated, and then obviously the normal tears. And so he was looking at it from an intelligent design standpoint, and as a result, he discovered something that an evolutionist might not have thought of seeing. So as we wrap this up, what are the implications of recognizing design in nature? Well, studying nature from this perspective, like I said, allows us to make discoveries that we might not otherwise. And another example of this are vestigial structures. So you've probably heard of these. Vestigial structures are organs or bones in your body that are left behind from evolutionary ancestors. So examples of this in our body would be the tailbone or the appendix or tonsils. And years ago, these were all considered to be vestigial or leftover remnants. And what they found in recent years is, you know, by approaching this from an intelligent design standpoint, saying there must be a reason God made us with a tailbone. You know, other organisms have tailbones for their tails. We don't have a tail. Why do we have a tailbone? And what they found is that there are 9 muscles in our body that attach to the tailbone. The tailbone is an anchorage point. And so for someone to say that it's a vestigial bone is ridiculous, because you take that bone out and all of a sudden you would have several different muscles that would not function. About 100 years ago, there was a book that was written by a German scientist where he listed 120 or 180, over 100 different vestigial structures in the human body, which he claimed to be useless organs or bones. And since then, every single one of those has been shown to have a purpose. So to say that something is vestigial is like claiming you know everything about human anatomy and physiology, or else you can't claim that something doesn't have a purpose. Perhaps you just haven't discovered the purpose yet. So there's a lot we can learn by approaching nature from, or approaching science from this perspective of intelligent design. And then, of course, what's the another implication is that if there is a God, as we see from all this evidence, who is he? Because wouldn't you want to know? In other words, if there was someone who created all this, wouldn't you want to know who this great person was? So as we conclude, a couple of scriptures. First, Psalm 19, verse 1. Says, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. So we look up at the night sky, we learn of all of these amazing discoveries in astrology, and it should immediately point us to the God who created it all. In Psalm 19 Psalm 14, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. God says it's foolish for us to live in this amazing world, even to see our own bodies, and to still say there is no God. There is ample evidence in nature for us to see that there is a creator. And finally, Romans 1, verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So for someone to say that they have studied biology, that they have studied astronomy, or chemistry, or physics, and they don't see evidence for a God, means that they're intentionally looking past something. They're deceiving themselves, because God says we are all without excuse. And you don't have to study science to be able to look at a complex animal or a complex human and say there must have been a creator here. So I hope those things have helped you to sort of ground your faith in a God, or at least be able to express these things to friends, neighbors, co-workers, fellow students, to say, look, this is convincing evidence that there is a God from nature. So thank you very much.